there are tens of thousands of federal statutes. I believe the number I heard was 300,000.
Right.
The specific nature of the crimes and the potential punishment is an issue that you've talked about,
mm-hmm.
to the point where you're asking the lawmakers to be a little bit more careful about punishing people, stopping their lives, putting them in jail, or finding them where they're bankrupt on such small crimes.
And it's not an issue that's really new. It's something that scholars have been yelling into the void about for a long, long time. They've been saying, hey, look, the criminal sanction is reserved for these extreme consequences, these extreme wrongs to society. And when Congress gets so careless that they allow 300,000 or 500,000, nobody really knows the number. I mean, these are all guesses. But when they allow that many things to be criminally punishable, right? That's the number of things that can make a person forever branded a criminal. They do need to be more careful. Partisan lines really shouldn't even get involved in that. I think we should all acknowledge that, hey, look, maybe some of these things are civil wrongs, but they shouldn't be criminal wrongs.
What would be the solution for trying to at least bring this down to a reasonable pairing of the laws? Because the general areas that federal law, at least, are looking at over history, guns, drugs, immigration, fraud, are the major areas for federal crimes.
The Constitution, our founding document, says that the government's a government of limited powers, and it says the federal government pretty much leaves the states alone unless there's this interstate component involved, right? Or a foreign component involved. And through a provision of the Constitution called the Interstate Commerce Clause, Congress has effectively, over the last couple centuries, said virtually everything in modern American life has an interstate connection. I mean, the internet has done it for us. Yes, they have gone pretty far afield of those core crimes. Those do remain the ones that you listed: fraud, guns, drugs, immigration. Those remain the ones that are filling the court dockets. But you still have about 2% of the federal docket that's filled with these miscellaneous regulatory crimes, which means that a couple thousand people a year still are getting criminal convictions for things that you would never think of, like, you know, mislabeled fruit cocktail, or, I don't know, maybe clogging a toilet in a national forest. I don't know. But you know, those things get included.
But your point really being the severity of the implications of a federal crime could bar you from jobs.
Yep.
All the things that would be typical of just living your life.
And not to mention having to foot the bill for lawyers, which are expensive. Also, take aside imprisonment, set aside loss of rights. What about just being branded a criminal, right? A label that should be reserved for the most offensive moral wrongs in society, not things that we would think of as minutiae.
The attractive thing and the interesting thing, the funny thing about this book is the minutiae,
right,
that you're pointing up. So what's the weirdest thing that's in there that you've come across so far? Because I realize you haven't really... This is of the 300,000 laws, you've only got couple of thousand at this point.
Yeah, we'll have to circle up at the end of the next 800 years when I finish the task, and I'll tell you then. I've always loved margarine crimes. I've loved these crimes that came out of the feuding between margarine and the dairy industry. And when margarine was effectively getting punished by dairy producers, and they were saying, we want to make it very hard for margarine to do business and eat up our market share. So they put all these onerous requirements, some of which remain on the books today, like if you're serving individual servings of margarine in a restaurant, they must be triangular in shape. I like that particularly issue close to my heart, because here in Hartford, Connecticut in the 1950s, a guy named Joe Trowoski was actually hauled off and charged criminally for selling square pats of margarine in his restaurant.
Well, the food crime pyramid is a favorite of mine. When I looked at it, I copied the page. And the margarine and butter crimes you just referenced are at the top of the food pyramid,
mm-hmm.
followed by the fruit and vegetable crimes, the meat, egg, and dairy crimes, and the bread and pasta crimes. And I think the prime example that you point to in the book is the ham and cheese sandwich.
Right.
And the regulatory impacts of the ham and cheese sandwich. Would you explain that for the unknown listeners?
Yes, sure. So, I mean, we all have heard of the ham sandwich's unique role in the criminal justice system, which is that it's the old lore of all criminal defendants is, hey, look, you could indict a ham sandwich because it's very easy to get an indictment. But what a lot of people don't know is how regulated a ham and cheese sandwich actually is in the United States, so much so that two federal agencies, the FDA and the USDA, they regulate that sandwich intermittently depending on where it is in its life cycle. So,
and whether there's a piece of bread on top
exactly
or not.
Right. There are government guidance documents that have been issued. You can go find them on the internet real easy, where the USDA and FDA have drawn a line in the sand and they've said, okay, open face sandwiches, you have that. Closed face sandwiches, we'll take that over here. And it's sort of ludicrous if it wasn't real, and it's true. So every component of a ham and cheese sandwich is regulated by the federal government in some way.
Now, we just had an incident recently about weather forecasting by a non-meteorologist, and there are statutes for this, right, which I would like you to address.
No, it's exactly right. And so this was something of a kerfuffle, right? We had an actual, you know, National Weather Service forecast. There were disputes about whether or not Alabama was going to be affected as a state or not. And for reasons untold, we were all shown in America a weather forecast projection by the president that showed some manipulation, we'll call it, right? There was a circle that was extended into Alabama. A few years back, I had tweeted that it is, in fact, a federal crime to issue a counterfeit or a false weather service forecast. There's a good faith concern there, which is you don't want to cause panic, or you also don't want to cause people to stay put when they're in real danger. And it is one of those crimes that has virtually never been prosecuted, but we did see what appeared to be a pretty blatant example of it, right? A forecast issued that was wrong. And what I did there was I actually broke out an earlier tweet, which didn't have much context. It sounded silly, but a lot of people said, well, this is never going to happen, right? Who's ever going to do this? What is the circumstance in which this happens? And now we were staring in the face of a very real example where, okay, there is a National Weather Service forecast that has been manipulated and it's false and it's being represented as true. And so I drilled into the legislative history, how it came about, what concerns were being addressed there, and it became part of the conversation. Do I think the president is going to get prosecuted for that? No, I don't. But it is important to know that we have so many federal criminal statutes on the books that you can, in fact, accidentally commit a federal crime, even if you're president.
What did you expect to be asked about this that you haven't been asked yet?
The thing that sort of lurks in the background that I think a lot of people think, sometimes they say, is, are people actually prosecuted for these crimes? Probably not. You know, how much of a problem is this? Is this worth addressing? To that, I always go back to this notion that we watched Schoolhouse Rock, and we watched how a bill gets made, and we sort of had an understanding of what the Constitution says, and we said, look, the people in Washington are writing the laws, they go through this bicameral legislature, then the president looks at them and either vetoes it or he signs it, and that's how we get laws, and those are laws to be respected. And I do think that it's a problem when Washington is sort of divorced from the lawmaking process, and that you have these regulations where regulators are not trying to create crimes, Congress isn't paying attention, and you end up with this body of criminal law. What you end up doing is ceding not just power from Congress to regulators, but all of that power essentially to prosecutors. And I think what we've seen, if we've seen anything over the last couple of years, it's that when you entrust too much enforcement authority in particular people, if you don't agree with those decisions, or if they're politically motivated, that can be a pretty scary thing. And under the current system, unless there's change, there's not a whole heck of a lot we can do about it. I think, if anything, some of these things may have started out looking like a lark. They may have looked silly or as some sort of just pure satire. But the truth is, I think they actually touch on a deeper issue, which is how much discretion do we want to entrust people with when our freedom is on the line. You know, we've sort of touched on that, but I think that's an important point that underlies the whole project.